Welcome to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff in studio with Peter Phillips. On today's program for the hour, we are joined by author and scholar Lawrence H. Shoup. We'll be talking about his newest book, Wall Street's Think Tank, The Council on Foreign Relations and the Empire of Neoliberal Geopolitics from 1976 to 2014. Stay with us. We're the promise of a legacy, a spirit we're honoring, an anomaly to those who can't imagine a world without oppressive forces slaving for almighty dollar bills. Welcome to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff in studio with Peter Phillips. Today, we are very fortunate to be joined for the hour by author Dr. Lawrence Shoup. His latest book is called Wall Street's Think Tank, The Council on Foreign Relations and the Empire of Neoliberal Geopolitics, 1976 to 2014. The Council on Foreign Relations is the most influential foreign policy think tank in the United States, claiming among its members a high percentage of government officials, media figures, and establishment elite. For decades, it kept a low profile, even while it shaped policy, advised presidents, and helped shore up U.S. hegemony following World War II. In 1977, Lawrence Shoup, with William Minter, published the first in-depth study of the CFR, Imperial Brain Trust, an explosive work that traced the activities and the influence of the CFR from its origins in the 1920s through the Cold War. And now, Lawrence Shoup returns with this long-awaited sequel, Wall Street's Think Tank, and he follows the CFR from the 1970s through the end of the Cold War, the collapse of the Soviet Union to the present, and explains how members responded to rapid changes in the world, including globalization, the rise of China, the so-called War on Terror, among other major developments. Lawrence Shoup joins us today for the hour to talk about the history of the CFR and its impact on current events. Here is Peter to introduce Larry to you. Peter?
Lawrence Shoup got his PhD from Northwestern University back in the 70s, and he's done several books, including Imperial Brain Trust, which was on the Council of Foreign Relations originally. And he's done a People's History of Early California, and many articles and scholarly publications over the years. He's taught at various universities, including the University of Illinois, San Francisco State, and Sonoma State, and been a longtime activist. His new book, Wall Street Think Tank, has a subtitle, The Council on Foreign Relations and the Empire of Neoliberal Geopolitics from 1976 to 2014. And this is just out. I've had the pleasure of reading that this past week. Larry, thanks so much for joining us.
Nice to be here. Thank you for having me.
Now, you describe the Council of Foreign Relations as the management committee for the capitalist ruling class, not only in the U.S., but increasingly the world. Tell us the history of the CFR. How did it originate and why they're so important?
Well, there were two key sources back in the First World War period. The first one was a businessman's organization that was founded in 1918, whose leading figure was Elihu Root, who was the Secretary of Treasury and Secretary of State and a senator. And he was very important in the transition of the United States from a continental power to a world power. And that was his vision. And he founded a businessman's organization during the First World War. This idea was called the Council on Foreign Relations. The idea was to expand the U.S. economic interests abroad, expand the power of U.S. economic interests abroad. So that was the first source. The second source came out of something called the Inquiry, which was a policy planning group set up by Woodrow Wilson and Colonel Edward House. And they had Walter Lippmann as the chair of their group, and they brought together scholars that were planning out U.S. war aims and what should be U.S. policy after the war. Then at the Paris Peace Conference at Versailles, they met with the British delegation and decided to form a joint Anglo-American Institute. And the council's kind of a British-connected and interested in allying with Britain. And Britain's ruling class wanted the United States to join with Britain in running the world at that time. So they talked about forming this joint Anglo-American think tank. One branch would be in Britain, one branch would be the United States. So the Britain one became the Royal Institute for International Affairs, which is still prominent in British foreign policy. And the United States one started to flounder until they met up with the Council on Foreign Relations and formed an organization which became, instead of the Anglo-American Institute for Foreign Affairs, which was the idea at Versailles in 1919, in 1921 they founded the Council on Foreign Relations, the new Council on Foreign Relations, joining the businessmen's group which wanted to expand abroad and the intellectuals that were characteristic of the inquiry, people from Harvard, Yale, Princeton, Columbia, the Ivy League schools especially. So this was the source of the Council on Foreign Relations. Right away, they formed a board of directors which had as its honorary president Elihu Root. He was a Wall Street lawyer who advised big corporations and big important capitalists like J.P. Morgan. And he was the honorary president. And then they brought together a lot of important J.P. Morgan-affiliated bankers, along with some other bankers too, and some lawyers and some academics. But it was dominated by the capitalist class from the beginning, and that's one of the main characteristics of the Council on Foreign Relations even today. It's a capitalist class-dominated organization. They formed a magazine called Foreign Affairs, which is called the Bible of Foreign Policy Thinking. Even today, it has a very large circulation. It is used not just in the United States, but also abroad. People interested in foreign policy in other countries read Foreign Affairs. This is their magazine, and they have a diversity of articles in Foreign Affairs. But if you know what the council's doing, you can read between the lines and know which articles are reflecting the council's point of view and which articles are provocative and just there for thinking and talking.
In the book, certainly in the 20s and 30s, this Council of Foreign Relations, it's not in the New York Times. It's not getting a lot of publicity. And it's kind of behind the scenes. And even today, to varying degrees, it's kind of behind the scenes. It was faced with a depression. But the main agenda, you write, was to promote capitalism and the best returns possible for American corporations around the world. And that continued. It continues up to the present. They had an economic perspective change. Originally, they were somewhat Keynesian and supported the New Deal.
Right.
And now they're much neocons and neoconservatives. Could you elaborate on that?
Yeah, they're definitely turned in the 70s. There was a change. But in the 70s was the beginning of it, where they wanted business to be less restrained. They wanted free enterprise to be really free enterprise, and the hell with the workers that were getting some benefits under Keynesianism. So they began to switch, and there's not too much difference in economic terms between the neocons and the neoliberals. They have the same kind of economic philosophy. They may have a different thing, a different take on some social things. But in terms of foreign policy and economic philosophy, they have the same idea, that is, free business from any constraints and use the state to promote business interests, whether it's giving corporate welfare or free trade agreements that are going to serve the corporations. They're interested in capital accumulation without restraint, whereas before there were some restraints because they had to pay attention to what the working class wanted. So you can see it even in the council's directors. They used to have, as council directors, people like Lane Kirkland, the head of the AFL-CIO, was a CFR director back in the 70s and 80s, but no more. Now there's very few, let alone directors, there are very few members that are leaders of unions today. They've pretty much dismissed the unions. They're not interested in what the unions want to do. They're interested in what capital wants to do, and the workers can take the hindmost. You know, forget about having some benefits for workers. So anything workers get, they need to fight for under this kind of regime, because they are very influential behind the scenes in the government and in society in general, in the media, in universities, in other think tanks, in lots of other policy organizations and lobbies. I have a whole chapter on showing how they have a vast network, which extends, another chapter showing how it extends internationally into the Bilderberg or the Trilateral and a lot of other international organizations, like the people that meet at Davos and so on. So the council has this vast network and is extremely powerful behind the scenes. I call it the most powerful organization, private organization, it's a private organization, in the world today. And so it's probably the most powerful private organization in world history.
Larry Shoup, I think it's certainly important that we understand that the Council of Foreign Relations is, we are describing as the management committee for the power elite. How are they organized? Now, let's talk about that.
Yeah.
They have a board of directors, but they have a membership.
Yeah.
And how are they funded? So how are they organized and how are they funded?
First of all, their membership is both individual members, U.S. citizens, only U.S. citizens. But then somebody like Rupert Murdoch can come from Australia, become a U.S. citizen, and get into the Council on Foreign Relations. You don't just join the Council on Foreign Relations. You have to be accepted by the Board of Directors of the Council on Foreign Relations. So they have 35 board members, and they are elected by the membership. The membership is almost 5,000 individual members, but they also have between 150 and 200, depending on the year, corporate members. These are members that are corporations, including international corporations like Deutsche Bank or, you know, some other big oil company abroad. They have those too. So they have corporate members that can be international. Their individual members have to be U.S. citizens. And so it's a very large organization. And that's the unique thing about the Council on Foreign Relations. It's both a think tank. They have their study groups, and that's a key thing that they do. They bring people together from diverse points of view, from diverse, well, I should say diverse points of view because their points of view are fairly narrow within neoliberalism. I should have said diverse interests that they try to reconcile and come to consensus within the capitalist class about what the direction should go. So they bring together study groups, up to 40, 50 people, where they discuss and read about and discuss in an important issue like China. They recently had a study group on a new grand strategy towards China. And this study group concluded that China has become too powerful and the United States has to control China's drive to world power and the U.S. has to maintain its world hegemony. That was the conclusion of a recent council study group. So they have study groups that draw on the 5,000 members and go beyond that, bring other people in who might be representing a particular constituency that they want to reach, and then they plan policy, and then because they have so many people in the government, National Security Advisor, the Secretary of State, the Secretary of Treasury are all members of the Council on Foreign Relations, invariably, including in the Obama administration. So they have direct access into the halls of power in the government, and they rely on the government to implement their policies, and they make the policies behind the scenes. So their organization then is a board of directors run by the capitalist class. If you look at them, you'll see that the majority, the great majority, are capitalist class members, and especially, of course, the chairman of the board, the vice chairman of the board. Those people are invariably capitalist class people, defined by having vast wealth, usually billionaires, sometimes only worth a few hundred million. Like in the case of Robert Rubin, he's the co-chair, he's only worth a few hundred million, whereas David Rockefeller, a former chair, and Peter Peterson, another former chair, were both billionaires. So the capitalist class runs it, the board of directors runs it, and then they have all these members that come to meetings. The other thing about them is they have study groups, but they also have a continuous, what they call a continuous conference on foreign policy and really domestic policy, because they're increasingly, they have a mission creep where they're doing more and more domestic policy things lately. So they bring in people important in U.S. life. And anytime some foreign dignitary is going to come to the United States, they invariably go to the Council on Foreign Relations to speak, because they know that the Council on Foreign Relations is an important, very important group to speak to. It's interesting, when Iran's president was elected, he came to the United States. He didn't really meet with Obama. He talked to Obama on the phone. But he met with the Council on Foreign Relations twice. He went to the council to speak to them, and then he met privately with the president of the Council on Foreign Relations. So he didn't talk to the president of the United States directly, but he did talk to Richard Haass, the president of the Council on Foreign Relations, directly, met with him. That's the new president of Iran some months back. So it's very interesting that the foreign people know that if they're, you know, government leaders or leaders in business, they know the Council on Foreign Relations is very important. I could tell a story that would be interesting to highlight this. When I was a graduate student, a French student came in, a graduate student at Northwestern University in Chicago. A French student flew in, and he had a mutual friend. We were having dinner together, and this is a guy, this French student that just got here to study in the United States. And he said, "Oh, Larry, what's your topic of your dissertation? I heard you're writing your dissertation." And I told him, "I'm interested in the ruling class forces behind American foreign policy." That's all I said. And he said, "Oh, you mean the Council on Foreign Relations, don't you?" I said, "Yes, I do mean the Council on Foreign Relations. But how do you know?" "Oh, my uncle's the head of the French CIA." And he said, "I worked at the French CIA headquarters, went into their archives, and in the French CIA archives, it says the shadow government of the United States is the Council on Foreign Relations."
Larry Shoup, we're going to take a musical break, but when we come back, we want to talk more about this shadow government and its many, many reaches, and also take the history of it from the 70s closer up toward the present. So we're speaking with author Lawrence Shoup. His newest book is Wall Street's Think Tank, The Council on Foreign Relations and the Empire of Neoliberal Geopolitics from 1976 to 2014. Please stay with us. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. Today, for the hour, we are joined by author Dr. Lawrence Shoup. His newest book is Wall Street's Think Tank, The Council on Foreign Relations and the Empire of Neoliberal Geopolitics, 1976 to 2014. Larry Shoup, just before the musical break, you mentioned the shadow government. And of course, on this program, we've talked about the deep state. We've talked about state crimes against democracy. We talk about secret government. Here we're now referring to this as shadow government. All of these things have some differences, or some subtle differences perhaps. But what we're really talking about and getting at is sort of the powers that be, the plutocracy that tends to control the system that is generally beyond public accountability.
Yeah, in fact, you know, interesting thing about that I mentioned in this book and that I've noticed since I've been studying the Council on Foreign Relations, which is many years that I've been studying the Council on Foreign Relations, but more recently I really noticed that these deep state actors or shadow government actors are oftentimes above the law. I give an example in the book. David Rockefeller was chairman of the Council on Foreign Relations for 15 years. And while he was chairman of the council, he was also chairman of the Chase Manhattan Bank, which wanted to get into China. And so he talked to Kissinger, who, of course, was an old council hand. That's how Kissinger got his start in power, was at the Council on Foreign Relations. He was a fellow there for a year. and wrote a book for the council back in the 50s. Well before. That's where he met the Rockefellers. It was well before he became powerful. Anyway, yes, Kissinger, who was in the Nixon administration, this was the early 70s, saying, how can I get the Chase Manhattan in on the ground floor in China? China's expanding. We want the Chase Manhattan Bank to have the best role there. And so Kissinger advised him, and he told his vice president to bribe the China ambassador to the UN. So his vice president sat with a suitcase, $50,000 cash, in the Roosevelt Hotel till the Chinese ambassador came in, then gave him this $50,000, said this is an instant loan and we don't need a receipt or anything. And, of course, Chase Manhattan Bank soon thereafter got the ground floor in China. Well, that's a felony. That's a felony to bribe a foreign official to get benefits. David Rockefeller, was he ever, he wrote about it in his memoirs. He's not worried about felonies. He's above the law. Similarly, you know, Bush and Cheney brag about torturing people. That's against the law. You can be executed in the United States. There's a law against torture. You can actually be executed. Are they worried about it? No, they're above the law. Certain people are above the law. So this capitalist class, large elements of it, and government officials that in the highest levels are above the law. And this is a shame on our democracy that people are above the law. Some people are above the law. And so the shadow government is what works behind the scenes. That's the way David Rockefeller was operating there, having direct relations with the Chinese government. He was having direct relations through bribery because the bribery led to meetings with the Chinese ambassador, which led to him getting in the ground floor at Chase Manhattan Bank. So that's the shadow government working behind the scenes in the economic realm. And they operate behind the scenes in the political realm, too. Susan Rice is the national security advisor for Obama. She doesn't advertise that she got her start at the Council on Foreign Relations some decades ago and was an active member of the Council on Foreign Relations for many years. She doesn't advertise that fact. You don't even hear about Susan Rice, but she's making policy behind the scenes. And she'll leave and she'll probably get a job with Chase Manhattan Bank or Goldman Sachs or some big oil company or something like Condoleezza Rice did. The same with Condoleezza Rice. She got her start in the Council on Foreign Relations too. Went on to become a Chevron director. That's the way you can get vast amounts of money because you don't even have to work very hard. You go to a few meetings and you make $100,000, $200,000, $500,000 a year for a few meetings. And then you get stock benefits. And pretty soon, you're part of the capitalist class yourself. So this is the way the system works to the detriment of the average person, of course. The average person doesn't have any such perks. The average person has to go into the labor market to try to get a job, take their hat off and be nice to the boss to try to get a job. This is an outrage, and we have to do something about it. I'm a revolutionary. We have to have a revolutionary change. And we haven't got to the ecological crisis, but the ecological crisis because of neoliberal geopolitics. That leads to the ecological crisis. You can't have an infinitely expanding economic system like capitalism on a finite planet. Sooner or later, we're going to destroy the ecological basis of life on Earth. It's only a question of when. So it has to be changed. That system has to change, or humanity is under threat for its very species existence.
Well, Larry Shoup, we're certainly talking about, you know, the Rockefeller. You mentioned Kissinger. Certainly, this is the transition from Johnson into the Nixon years. And this is what you and Peter were speaking earlier, the sort of the shift away from Keynesianism and more toward the neoliberal globalization and even a more neocon ideology. Certainly, some of the same characters from this period, Milton Friedman, Greenspan, some of these characters here. I want to go back here and say this is not happenstance, right? You talk about behind the scenes. You remember the Lewis Powell memo, 1971, right? And so in it, you know, they basically outline that there's this leftist attack on Western society and government and all this business. And they have a plan, basically, to, you know, dismantle the universities and the academies and attack organized labor, right? I mean, this was laid out, and this is just before Powell was appointed to the Supreme Court by President Nixon, right? And then that was eventually leaked to the media and had people beginning to question, well, what are some of these people on the court doing? Well, they're kind of paving the way for this these interpretations that are very friendly towards the type of policies that are put forward by people on Council of Foreign Relations.
Yeah.
So this is all connected.
Yeah, it was all connected. And I should mention the Trilateral Commission, which was an offshoot of the Council on Foreign Relations. One of their first publications of the Trilateral Commission, which the trilateral part is Western Europe, North America, and Japan. And that's an international organization that was founded by David Rockefeller, chairman of the the council, and a council director, Zbigniew Brzezinski. They founded the Trilateral Commission, and their one of their first publications was authored by Harvard professor Samuel P. Huntington, a CFR member, and he talked about the excess of democracy, that there was a democratic distemper, that we had to cut down democracy, we had to wipe out excess democracy. Of course, there's no excess of democracy in the United States. It's a very controlled democracy.
Paucity.
A joke for a democracy. It's a fraud. It's financed by the rich. If the people organize, they can maybe get some influence, but the people are disconnected by all kinds of things, racism among them, gender discrimination as well, and the capitalist class foments that, promotes that in order to divide and conquer the workforce. So this definitely was a plan. It was implemented over a number of years, and the council had something called the 1980s Project that they started in the 1970s, and in that they talk about neoliberalism as a system. And in their reports that they had a number of books. That's the thing about the council. They have a vast number of books, reports, blogs, their website. If you're interested in the council and you want to go even beyond my book, you can get up-to-date information at cfr.org. I think it's important to read my book first, because my book has the framework that you need to understand CFR.org and not be bulldozed and propagandized by what they're putting forward on their website. But they do have a tremendous amount of information on the website, and you can get their annual reports for the last 15 years or so. So you can look at the membership, you can see who the members are, the names of the members, and you'd be pretty shocked about how many prominent names in American life are in the Council on Foreign Relations membership list. So it was a plan. They did implement it over time. Reagan played a big role in it, and you would have thought that Reagan from the right wouldn't be that connected, because, see, the Council on Foreign Relations is kind of the mainstream of the capitalist class, the middle of the road, and they even listen to liberal voices sometimes because they want to know what liberal people are thinking. It's not reflective of the right wing, the Koch brothers. The Koch brothers are not in the Council on Foreign Relations. Their network is not very well connected. There are a few people in that network that are Council on Foreign Relations people, but generally they're not. The ones that are better connected are the Harvard types or the Yale types and the big finance capitalists. The Koch brothers are kind of an outlier, and they have a different perspective on the state, the role of the state. The Koch brothers don't want the big state. Or at least they say they don't want the big state. That's at least their ideology. Whereas the council, of course, relies on the big state for all kinds of things. They want the strong government that they control. And I have a section in my book that shows that 80% of all top policymakers, about 100 top policymakers that I listed in this part of the book, 80% of them were members of the Council on Foreign Relations, which is a pretty astounding figure, I think, when you think that there are other think tanks, there's other policy groups, there's other forces within the society. Why are 80% of the top policymakers from this one organization? Well, it's because it's the most powerful organization in the United States and the world.
So the Council on Foreign Relations is the kind of the central policy-making organization for capitalism and promotes,
yeah, I think so,
free trade, global trade, neoliberal approaches to capitalism, minimum government interference, especially from other countries in particular.
That's right.
And they're very much behind NAFTA, the TPP that's pending now before Congress, and the TTIP, which is the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Policy, which would control, those trade agreements would control 60% of the global GDP.
Right. So this gets to my subtitle, Neoliberal Geopolitics. And what do I mean by that term? That is the term, I believe, that describes U.S. foreign policy, and it describes the council perspective. So it's both neoliberalism and geopolitics. If you take the TPP just as an example, the geopolitical aspect is excluding China. People have said, well, gee, why isn't China in the TPP? You'd think that would be good to have them, too, as part of the trade thing. You'd get some good trade going there, right? No, that would increase China's geopolitical power. And you want to isolate China and increase your close connections to the other people in the TPP, including Vietnam, Japan, India, all these other countries that are part of the TPP. And then the neoliberal aspect is you increase the trade and you increase the power of corporations. That is, these trade agreements are very nefarious because they have within them these ways that the corporations can control. If there's a dispute, then they have a dispute mechanism that they can resolve the dispute. But who's on these arbitration panels that resolve the dispute if there's a dispute? So, for example, a dispute between the environmental regulations of California and the TPP. If there's a dispute, it goes to this arbitrating panel, which is dominated by corporate people, including CFR people. So they're going to rule in favor of the corporations. So it's moving towards more and more of a corporate state, more and more towards a fascist type of corporate state. I wouldn't say we have fascism in the United States at this point, but the trend is not good. And we see neo-fascists or semi-fascists like Trump getting to, you know, be prominent. So it's within the society that's developing, as well as within the power structure that has so much to do with how the society develops. And so we're running into towards more and more of a corporate state, less and less power for working people. Unions are at a very low ebb. They're down to 12% of the workforce. That's 88% of the workforce is not in a union in the United States. That is ridiculous. In other countries, it's much higher, should be much higher. So workers don't have a way to defend themselves. And so these trade agreements are examples of this neoliberal geopolitics that I think is the dominant framework for U.S. policy these days, based on the Council on Foreign Relations power and their ideas.
You're listening to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. We're speaking with author Dr. Lawrence Shoup. His latest book is Wall Street's Think Tank, The Council of Foreign Relations and the Empire of Neoliberal Geopolitics, 1976 to 2014. We will continue our discussion with Larry Shoup after this musical break. Stay with us.
Oh, how it
You got to be cool on Wall Street. Thanks to Anthony Fest, our producer, for our fun music selections today. This is the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. We're speaking with author Dr. Lawrence Shoup. His latest book, Wall Street's Think Tank, The Council on Foreign Relations and the Empire of Neoliberal Geopolitics, 1976 to 2014. This is really a riveting book, quite comprehensive in so many ways, a few hundred pages, very well noted. And we're going through some of it here, and we're going to focus our attention. Of course, this is our bias on the Project Censored Show. We want to talk about CFR in the media. And Larry Shoup, you've got segments in the book here on major foundations, on the major media. Talk to us a little bit about this. Talk to us about what you found out when you started to look into sort of the many tentacles here of CFR and their influence.
There's a group that ranks, some private ranking organization that ranks major print media as to their influence. The number one is foreign affairs. Behind the foreign affairs are things like the New York Times or the Washington Post or other print media. So the CFR's own internal journal that you can buy or subscribe to, Foreign Affairs, is the most important print media in the United States, according to this survey. Now, the Council on Foreign Relations has lots of other connections, of course, into the media, both print and broadcast media. Even in PBS, you know, you would think that PBS, they wouldn't have that many connections. It would be more the New York Times and the NBC, CBS, ABC, so on. But interestingly enough, if you tune into public television and you see Judy Woodruff there talking, she's a CFR member. And if you see Margaret Warner talking about foreign policy, she's a CFR director, Margaret Warner, which you wouldn't expect. You'd be kind of surprised. But that's an example of how deep the connections are between the CFR and the major media. Another example is The Nation magazine, which is what they call it, the flagship of the left. And it's been in existence since the Civil War period. And has done a lot of very honorable things over the years. I have a lot of respect for them. But editor-in-chief and one of the major owners, Catherine Vanderhoeven, is a CFR member. And she's been active in the CFR. Her husband's another CFR member who's been on a number of CFR study groups. So they have a liberal wing in the CFR. It's smaller than the dominant majority centrist wing. And then they have a big conservative wing, a neocon wing as well. So it's amazing that they have all these connections in the mainstream media, but also in some of the alternative media. So it's hard to get out from under and have a critical expose from these media sources because they don't like to cover the CFR. For example, if you watch the PBS, they oftentimes do have someone on that says Council on Foreign Relations. Judy Woodruff or Margaret Warren never mentions what the Council on Foreign Relations is. It'll just say, this Joe Blow from the Council on Foreign Relations is talking to us today. They never mention what it is. And then oftentimes, they also have somebody on, oh, he's a Harvard professor. Yes, he's a professor, but he's also a CFR member. Or he's a Washington Post columnist, but he's also a CFR member. They never mention the CFR connection with these other people that are on. So I haven't made an estimate or done a media study. These kinds of studies take a long time if you're trying to look at all the media coverage of a particular event. And, you know, that's a lot of work to look at all the different things that are covering the TPP, for example. That would be a lot of work to check into that. But just from watching PBS a lot, the TV, I would say that a third or to a half of the people they have on are CFR members. But they don't tell you that they're CFR members in most cases. They do sometimes.
And on top of that, since the 80s, the CFR has put out a couple hundred books, 1,800 academic journal articles, 4,500 op-ed pieces, and that's all in the corporate media or else out there. So.
Exactly, yeah, and they testify before Congress. Yeah, I should have mentioned all those. They've had, I looked at it, and since the 1980s, they've had tens of thousands of various types of publications, led, of course, by books. And we really haven't talked about the Iraq War, but one of their books came out in 2002, Threatening Storm, The Case for Invading Iraq. And, of course, the Council on Foreign Relations is all over being behind Iraq, and they put out a book ahead of time and articles in Foreign Affairs magazine. The subtitle of one was, It's the Oil, Stupid. That's the subtitle of one of their articles in Foreign Affairs advocating for invading the Persian Gulf. They put out all these publications, and some of them sometimes you'll know that it's a council person that's writing for, you know, some magazine. Sometimes you don't know because they put down, I'm a Harvard professor or I'm a Washington Post editor or whatever. They don't put down the Council on Foreign Relations connection. But if you start studying the council, you start seeing that they're everywhere, and you kind of feel inadequate, as I do sometimes. One person cannot adequately cover the Council on Foreign Relations. I think I've done a pretty thorough job with this book, and it's worthwhile, I think, for anyone to have a look at it. But we certainly need an entire think tank to study the capitalist class. The closest thing we have is Project Censored. But it's a small group also, you
we
know.
Try.
It's almost like, yeah, it's almost like me trying to study the Council on Foreign Relations. Do a good job with what you have, but there's a lot more there to look at.
Actually, the first story 40 years ago that Carl Jensen had, the number one story, was on the Trilateral Commission. And how Jimmy Carter was a member then. And, of course, that was straight out of the Council of Foreign Relations. And
right. The international
I know
branch.
We've covered CFR a number of times, so it's something to think about.
But we need an entire big think tank funded, hopefully, by labor unions to study, but they spend all their money on the Democrats instead. Anyway, to study the American capitalist class and where they're going. Because if you can see where they're going and what they're doing, this is a leg up for the people's movements. And we need the people's movements organized and active to try to counter the kind of power that they have, to try to keep the chance that the average person has to have a decent life and a decent education, decent health care, and all those things that we need and all of us need.
Larry Shoup, we've had William Robinson on our show here, and we've spent some, I've addressed a number of times, the transnational capitalist class or the global 1,000th of 1%. And some, we know some of these are CFR members, but talk about what the new Council of Councils and how they are interlocked with the Bilderbergers and Davos and European groups.
Yeah, I have a whole chapter on the Council and its international connections where I start out with the Bilderberger Group, which actually is something that the European nobles started. And of course, who were they going to invite to be their partners in the United States but the Council on Foreign Relations people like David Rockefeller? So that's the Bilderberger Group. It's just, it meets only once a year, but it's very powerful behind the scenes in many different countries. And their people oftentimes take office. And an offshoot of that is the Trilateral Commission, which David Rockefeller and Zbigniew Brzezinski at one of the Bilderberger meetings said, you know, the Japanese, this was in the 70s, early 70s, the Japanese are becoming powerful economically, so we should bring the Japanese in. And the Bilderberger European nobles sat up in their seat and said, no, we don't want the Japanese. And Rockefeller wrote in his memoirs, they politely but firmly said, no, we're not having those Japanese in our organization. So anyway, Rockefeller, who was chairman of the council, and Brzezinski, who was the director of the council, formed the Trilateral Commission, which brings together Western European leaders, North American leaders, and Japanese leaders into one organization, which is more recent years have expanded to include Chinese leaders, Mexican leaders, and some others as well. So the Trilateral Commission is very important behind the scenes internationally. There's others like the Davos meetings that the council is very prominent. If you look at any of these groups, these international groups, you find that the Council on Foreign Relations is very prominent. And this is the formulation or the founding and development of a transnational capitalist class, which works together and has, I think it's manifested partly in the conglomerates. And I haven't studied it as much as I'd like. Robinson is quite an expert in it, and I appreciate his work. It's worth looking at that book if you're interested in this topic. But first, look at my chapter, because I outline the whole transnational thing and how the council fits into that. So that's the developing thing, that you've got conglomerates that are transnational. There's a big Canadian conglomerate, which has Belgian and other connections. And the U.S., of course, has all these connections through the Council on Foreign Relations. The other thing I should mention is the council has an international advisory board as well, where they bring together prominent, especially businessmen, billionaires. The Indian billionaire, for example, is the guy that owns the largest private home on the planet. His private home cost $1 billion and is 27 stories high. It has a staff of 600 and has its own 3 helicopter pads and its own air traffic control system. It's an amazing thing in Mumbai. He's, on the International Advisory Board for the CFR. And, of course, they have the Rockefellers of Sweden, the Wallenberg family, which is very important in Sweden, but also connected to lots of other corporations nations around the world. And so these people interact with each other in the council, but also in the Bilderberger. Most of them are Bilderberger or the Trilateral or at Davos. And they're coming to the same kind of worldview. And except as it sometimes applies to them, they might talk about neoliberalism as wanting the small state, but they want the big state for themselves, of course. They want all the benefits of the big state, whether it's police protection, military intervention, to conquer some area. That's the other thing you need to realize, that these people want to open up other countries. So you invade Iraq because Iraq has a national economy, a nationally controlled economy. You break it open so that neoliberal corporations can come in and have power in that society. That's what leads to these aggressive types of wars.
So you say break it open. I want to talk about agency there as to how that implies what Peter Dale Scott calls a deep state, and certainly actors within government and military and private organizations implementing policy directions from the CFR, whether it's Ukraine or Iraq or Iran, certainly policies towards Israel and support there, some of which is boots on the ground, drone strikes, assassinations. Not that they're saying go kill somebody, but certainly they're saying if we're going to control the economy of African countries, we need to have operating teams there that can threaten who we need to threaten.
That's another aspect. When you look at the council's membership, you find that there's a large number of generals, admirals, and other high military officials are members of the Council on Foreign Relations. I think it's 60-some-odd was the claim made by 2014. The CFR's 2014 annual report said that 60-some military, top military officials, generals, admirals, and so on, are members of the Council on Foreign Relations. Well, one of them, interesting enough, is Stanley McChrystal, who's been the head of the Joint Operations Terrorism Force, you could call it, because what they do is in country after country, dozens of them, like 70 according to one report, they invade the country at night, taking out people at their whim and caprice, killing people. Of course, they do that on a massive basis in some places. They did that in Iraq during the Iraq War from 2003 to 2011. They did that all the time. But they also do it, to other countries that are supposedly peaceful countries. So McChrystal, he's a member of the council, and he went from being just a colonel to being a general after he was a year-long fellow at the council. They have military fellows. Well, McChrystal was nominated by Dick Cheney to be a military fellow at the council in the late 1990s. And then he became, right after that, as soon as he got done with that, he was a general and moved to the top echelon. And he's, of course, been reported that he has organized torture when he was one of the generals in Iraq. And Petraeus did too, of course. General Petraeus is another member of the Council on Foreign Relations. So they have top military officials as well. So when they're organizing drone strikes and so on, and the council's in favor of drone strikes, although the council has had a report, which I cover in my book, that they want to try to make them a little bit more transparent so that people will accept drone strikes more. There was too much criticism. So they had a report to try to cut that criticism down.
We're speaking with author Dr. Lawrence Shoup. His new book, Wall Street's Think Tank, The Council on Foreign Relations and the Empire of Neoliberal Geopolitics, 1976 to 2014. We're going to continue our conversation with Larry Shoup after this musical break. Stay with us.
Thank you.
Welcome back to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. Today on the program, we are joined by Dr. Lawrence Shoup. His latest book, Wall Street's Think Tank, The Council on Foreign Relations and the Empire of Neoliberal Geopolitics, 1976 to 2014. I suppose, Larry Shoup, we could say 1976 and leave. You had to finish somewhere.
I had to finish somewhere.
Yeah,
it's ongoing. Right.
Indeed it is. So we have about 10 minutes left in the program here. Let's continue to get into what you're revealing about this major organization in terms of influence, but one that's where very little seems to be known and it's not very discussed widely publicly. So, Peter?
Larry, this operation, they're doing these study groups and they're having meetings all over the world and international councils. Where are they getting all their money and how much money are we talking about?
They have about $500 million in assets and those are invested. So the certain amount of investment income, and of course they have some of the biggest capitalists on the planet advising them as to their investments. So you can certainly expect that they get a certain amount of money each year from their investments. They don't get any money from public sources. They don't take government money, for example. They take private money. The biggest single contributor historically is David Rockefeller. David Rockefeller became a member of the Council on Foreign Relations in 1941, became a director of the Council on Foreign Relations in 1949. He was chairman from 1970 to 1985, and now he's the honorary chairman of the Council on Foreign Relations. He's still alive. He's 100 years old this year. So he is the biggest single donor, and the Council mentions their donors every year. They have a list in their annual report. And David Rockefeller is always in the top group ever since, you know, who knows when. But all the council annual reports I have, which is from 1974 to the present, always list David Rockefeller in the top group of major funders. One year they did mention that David Rockefeller gave $25 million and above during one year. So we can expect that David Rockefeller has given a substantial amount, you know, who knows what, how many hundreds of millions that he's given to the Council on Foreign Relations over the years. So their annual budget is somewhere around $100 million, as I recall. They have a big staff and a large operation, including two headquarters now. They have a headquarters in New York. That's traditional headquarters. But they recently, in the last few years, set up a headquarters in Washington, D.C., and that's where, interestingly enough, I should mention this little anecdote. Hillary Clinton was Secretary of State when they started their Washington headquarters, their second headquarters, and she was invited to give the inaugural speech there, and she opened it up by saying, "I'm very glad to be here at the Council on Foreign Relations because I always had to go to the mothership in New York to get advice, but now you're just around the corner from us, and we don't have to go so far in order to get advice from you and to know what to think about the future," quote unquote. We want to know what to think about the future, and we learn it from you. So they have these big operations, so they need a lot of money. This is a plutocratic organization. They have members from the Vanderbilt family, the DuPont family, the Rockefeller family, the Mellon family, the Heinz Ketchup family, which, interestingly enough, John Kerry intermarried with the Heinz Ketchup family. He's worth almost $1 billion because he married Teresa Heinz after her husband was killed in a plane crash. So our Secretary of State is not only a council member, his daughter's a council member, his brother's a council member, his wife is a council member, and he's worth vast sums of money because he's part of the American plutocracy. His name, his full name is John Forbes Kerry, and Forbes is one of the Boston Brahmin families. And so he comes from Boston, and his father was not a Boston Brahmin, but his mother was. And so anyway, the plutocracy doesn't have any trouble funding their operations. They just go out, and they did get a lot of money from foundations. Those are the usual foundations, the Rockefeller Foundation, the Ford Foundation, and so on. The Mellon Foundation, too, a whole lot of foundations normally consider might be conservative, like the Mellon Foundation. They give to the Council on Foreign Relations. So they have foundation sources, they have their own private sources from the plutocracy, and then they have very wealthy individuals that give vast amounts of money at a one go. When they want to fund something, they say, well, we need to set up a big donor effort, and then they put in David Rockefeller or Douglas Dillon or someone that's very wealthy, Robert Rubin. The current co-chair of the council is Robert Rubin. He made a lot of money. Of course, he got Glass-Steagall through in the Clinton administration. Bill Clinton was a member of the Council on Foreign Relations, too. They deregulated the Wall Street banks. Well, who benefited from that? The Wall Street banks and especially Citibank, where Robert Rubin quit right after Glass-Steagall was quit as Secretary of the Treasury and put in his protege, Lawrence Summers, another CFR member. But he quit and went over to Citibank, which benefited from that, and got $40 million a year salary. That was his salary. 1 year, $40 million. Every year, $40 million.
So, Larry, how do people get in? How do people get into the council? How do their how's their staff chosen? Are these endowed chairs? I mean, how does that
work? Some are endowed chairs, and their staff is chosen by the board of directors. The board of directors, it's a very top-down corporate organization. You know, it's a very corporate-dominated organization, top-down. To be a member of the Council on Foreign Relations, you have to apply, and you have to be recommended by other council members. It's very in-groupy. If you don't know a council member, or at least two, you forget about getting in. And then you apply. You have to fill out a large form, and then they'll look it over and then talk to other people and decide whether you fit into the council format. So they want it to be a carefully balanced combination of business interests, academics, government officials, journalists, publicize themselves, and nonprofits, including university presidents, but that goes into the university. So they don't want to get too academic. Overly academitized, they call it. We don't want to be overly academic. We want to be practical. So we have to have the big businesses in there because they're the ones that have the foreign interests that we want to protect or expand their interests. So we have to have them in there in the proper proportion. If we get too many academics, then we're just talking about abstract things or irrelevant things. We want the academics to apply themselves to how to control Iraq, for example. You know, there's one thing before the Iraq war. They wanted academics or knowledgeable people. How do we control Iraq and make it a neoliberal paradise for our corporations? That's what we want. So let's do that. You know, so they have to have the right balance of these different elements.
Indeed. Well, Larry Shoup, we're almost out of time, but I wanted to point out that you do end your book, Wall Street's Think Tank, and that's Monthly Review Press. People can go online at Monthly Review Press and learn more. Concluding reflections, capitalist class rule versus democracy in the public interest. And again, I hate to do this because we're almost out of time, but I'm just ready to say you've got 30 seconds to say how we're going to fix it all.
Well, we have a lack of democracy in our country, so we all need to be fighting for a real democracy, and that involves direct action. I think we all have to be active in the movements that we choose, and there's a lot of them out there. We need to be active, and we need to be doing direct action. I think that's direct action delivers the goods. I don't put down political action. I'm a member of the Green Party. I think we have to have a left-wing party, and the Green Party is pretty good. Jill Stein's a pretty good presidential candidate. You should check it out. But direct action is going to deliver the goods, and that's what we have to do to save our planet and save ourselves.
Peter, last word?
At the end, you talk about the pathological agenda of the CFR. You just name it, predatory economics, and the idea that there's a doomsday machine in process in terms of the environment. So I just wanted to leave that last word out there. Thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure.
You're tuned to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. Special thanks to our producer, Anthony Fest. Our engineer is Erica Bridgman. Project Censored Show airs on over 25 stations around the United States. Archives can be found at projectcensored.org. Please follow and like us on Facebook. Thanks so much for tuning in. We'll see you next time.
It's a dirty game maintained by Rainbow Capital Gain. But my people getting tired of the pain and the shame. We're not commodities or cars that turn the global economy. We're the promise of a legacy, a spirit we're honoring. An anomaly to those who can't imagine a world without oppressive forces, slaving for almighty dollar bills. We won. We got the love of the Thought Brothers and our sisters. The people together can overthrow the system. We won. We got that love of the Thought Brothers and your sisters. The people together can overthrow the system. We got the love of the Thought Brothers and our sisters.
Perpetrated by criminal minds, political ties, habitualized alibis, disguise under the guise of democracy, politics, and the apocalypse. Got the skies looking ominous. So the ocean burned bright with waves full of poison. Genocide wars fall for little boys, and the weapons manufactured paid for by attacks upon the bridges and the levees and the mines collapsing. All the prisons, build the capacity, citizens, and the ties for the master thief. Define and conquer, steal a masterpiece. Open your eyes and realize what's happening. Time's running out to reach all potential. If you ain't at the table, then you're probably on the menu. We got that love.